No, we won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Happy Ben Mazel Day, and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. I have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, I will start the show with Yuri Raskin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Then I'll be speaking with Malin Mitchell, who is running for Lieutenant Governor. I'll finish the hour with Edna Conkle and Dorothy Mickelberg, who will be talking about the We Are Women March next Saturday in Madison. In the second hour, I will start off the show with Liz DiNovella from the Progressive Magazine and Whitney from Wisconsin Citizen Media Co-op to discuss their experiences at the American for Prosperity meeting that happened in March. And I'll finish off the show with Scott Wyckoff from Badger Democracy, Charles Uphoff from Oregon Area Progressives, and Jan Moore from Spark, which is the Sun Prairie Group, to talk about grassroots. The phone number to call in if you have any questions or comments is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. I also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com. You can post all your comments and questions there. Now, before we get to Yuri, I just want to remind everyone, and again, we'll be discussing this a little bit later this hour, but Wisconsin's Unite Against the War on Women protest is a rally scheduled for the afternoon of April 28th in Madison, Wisconsin. This rally is part of a coordinated nationwide effort, a series of events to march and rally for women's against the war on women and for women's rights. The following confirmed speakers are Chris Taylor. She's emceeing. She's from Wisconsin Assembly. Mark Pocan, who is also from Wisconsin Assembly and a candidate for Congress. Kelda Helen Royce, Wisconsin Assembly and a candidate for Congress. And our very own Yuri Raskin from Janesville City Council and Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. And, of course, he's a candidate for Assembly. And, of course, the Raging Grannies and much more. To learn more about Wisconsin Unite Women, go to www.unitewomenwisconsin.org. It's unitewomenwi.org. With that, I'd like to welcome Yuri Raskin to the Sarah Schultz Show. Good morning, Yuri. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing, Good. Sarah?
I am doing good. What's the big news this week in our great state?
Well, there's several. We have our governor who decided to travel to Illinois, and there's a wonderful story in the Chicago Sun-Times that says, Illinois offers lessons for Wisconsin governor. It's just great, you know, because it kind of highlights the situation and not from Walker's point of view, which is that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has been spending a lot of time in Illinois of late. This week, he visited our capital, Springfield, and who can blame him? Our state's economy and job growth have far surpassed Wisconsin during his time in office. So this is, I think everyone will get a great kick out of reading this little story in Chicago Sun-Times. And of course, there was a lot of protesters in Springfield. There's some great pictures and feedback from different people. I guess there's somebody in a red costume and just, you know, people are having fun. Scott Walker has become kind of a traveling circus. And, you know, we are the people that we're going to, you know, show him for the clown that he is, I guess. Mean-spirited, bad clown that he appears to be.
I was just going to say, I read the Sun-Times article, and it was pretty amazing that the Illinois Chamber of Commerce and the other group that invited him to talk wanted him to talk after he's just spent months and months bashing Illinois. I mean, for a while, all he did was start out talking about how bad Illinois was, and yet they're like, oh, sure, Governor, after you've tried to bash what we're doing, come on down and tell us how to do it right. It's just as interesting.
It's the amazing thing about politics is that reality sometimes has little to do with what politicians choose to say and how they spin things. And I think the 8 years of George W. Bush is just a very clear example of how that works. Let's see, jumping to something that is maybe a little bit more lighthearted, but at the same time, important. There's a lot of signs we see around the state, and some of them are really funny, even unintentionally so. For instance, there's a We Support Walker sign that's been made by the Appleton Republicans, and it's been circulating all over the Facebook because they spelled governor that they're supporting, Governor E-R instead of Governor O-R. And there's already lots of jokes online, as I'm sure you and your listeners have encountered about all the misspellings in the Tea Party sign. Well, it appears that those same people are working on the official Republican postages, and here, you know, and at least we have cameras that we can take pictures. And, you know, we know the governor didn't graduate from college, but he's still Governor O.R., not Governor E.R.
But, and the governor wasn't the one that put the signs there. I'm assuming there's another group who did it. And as someone pointed out, they did spell Ozaki correctly, but they misspelled governor. So I don't know where the spell check was and how that they figured that out. But I would think that if you're going to put a sign up to support someone, can you do a spell check real fast before you send it out?
Exactly. Or, you know, that's a good point. There's probably some kind of a software involved, and somebody should have done a spell check. I don't know. Maybe they were just so certain of their righteousness and truthfulness that it felt right in their gut, and that's what they went with. But we will never know what really happened. So, moving on. Scott Walker, well, his administration had to announce that they lost 2,312 jobs in public education since he took office. That is really bad news, because this is such a disservice to our children. I have a kid in fifth grade. Lots and lots of people have children, and it hurts our entire state, whether you have children or not. And to lose over 2,000 education professionals when Wisconsin, our reputation was built on education, is just shameful. You know, it's frustrating, because as you read more and more about the news and you get involved in the process, the word shame comes up over and over, but you can't use the same word over and over. So you have to find different words. Even though shame and shameful is just such an apt way to describe what we've seen take place over the last year, it's very frustrating.
I'm trying to recall. I had just read something and I couldn't recall the numbers. How many jobs were actually lost? I thought someone had posted that there was a net gain of 5,400 jobs in the last year and a half since Walker, but I can't remember. And I think that was everything, because we've lost so many teachers' jobs, and we've lost so many, but we've gained some in the private sector. And I'm trying to recall how much we actually have, because remember, our goal was 250,000.
That's exactly right. I think the goal is what we need to remember, because if Scott Walker is going to keep on talking about how he's going to create 250,000, he probably created 250 jobs, or maybe not, then that's the number and that's the standard that he should be held to. And at the same time, we need to look at around us and see how easy it is to find a job in Wisconsin. You know, it's not. And so those, you know, we need to compare, because the details, you know, somebody can say it's 54,000, somebody can argue that it's 52,000. Does it really matter if the standard that Scott Walker set for himself is so unmeetable? And so I think whether it's plus a job or minus three jobs is unfortunately irrelevant to those who are trying to find a job.
He did create jobs in other states. Illinois got a big boost from people going to Illinois to work. And he created,
he's bringing in millions of dollars in advertising for recalls and elections of all sorts. So you can say that he's helping our economy that way, I suppose.
You could say that. And let's see, he helped create jobs in Canada. He's helping to create jobs in California with the driver's license. So he's creating jobs.
Right, printed in California. Yeah.
He's creating jobs. It just doesn't happen to be in the state of Wisconsin. You know, and he did say he was going to create 250,000 jobs, and he never said it was going to be in Wisconsin. He just kind of was ambiguous about it. So maybe if we added all those jobs, he actually will create 250,000 jobs. It just won't be in our state.
That's right. Maybe they will be in the known universe.
Within the North American continent, maybe.
Right. If you look up in the sky, there's 50,000 jobs he created on Mars, but you can't see them. I don't know. I mean, if you're going to loosen the standards to meet whatever you can find room under the sun, I guess, to put in a press release, then it's a different, and that's politics again, because how is this helping real people and real Wisconsinites? I mean, come on. So I think that that's that's arguing about the numbers, you know. So I think that really doesn't help the state, and neither does Scott Walker. So,
well, and
I
know you're trying to go on, and I'm not going to let you for a minute. The millions spent on advertising don't seem to trickle down to everyone else either. So that just kind of – that helps whoever he's throwing the advertising to. It's not really coming down to the state. And the other thing is, before you move on, it was with education. I believe that the schools are bolstering are keeping themselves afloat right now with some of the federal money that they still had. We don't actually know the full effects of the cuts until next year when the federal money runs out. Am I mistaken on that? I thought I had read that somewhere. That's
no, I think that's exactly correct. And, in fact, it's your show. So if you want to talk about any particular issue, we'll just talk about that particular issue, Sarah, because it's the Sarah Schultz Show. So you're exactly right. The money that's keeping afloat a big part of the education and preventing education further cuts is that federal money that's left over. And of course the joke is that money was there specifically to prevent the layoffs, and once that money runs out with all the cuts, it's going to be terrible irony, because it's not going to prevent us from cuts, it's just going to delay the cuts, because we have people who I think frankly just don't care for government, just don't think that government can be of any good to people. And it's unfortunate, because government has way too much power to just be wasted. So,
I was letting you move on.
Some more about education?
No, I was going to let you move on. Did you see how quiet I was? I was waiting for you to move forward into your next story.
All right. I will just – well, there's a couple of other things I wanted to mention. We have CJ out there who is lighting up Lori Compass signs, and he's looking for some help. And Lori Compass, you may recall, is running against Fitzgerald, who is for recall. So there you go. So if you're interested in helping CJ, you can contact him at emokid711@aol.com. And that's just a public service announcement right there.
Can you repeat that email?
The email is emokid711@aol.com.
Okay, thank you.
So, yep, absolutely. We have also top Walker aide, Tim Russell, who stole veterans' money. I think he's already been arrested for that. He also embezzled $542,000 in taxpayer money. So some would say that that's more numbers than we needed to recall Walker in the first place. So,
when is that possible indictment coming again?
I don't know.
And we don't know who else is going to be indicted, but there's a possible indictment out there coming. And
the drum roll is definitely there, and who knows when the other shoe will drop, and perhaps something exciting will happen with our governor there. He's been kind of under the two-prong attack from people and from the law. He's at the same time, he's not even really being liked by his own Republican Party, because while he may be treated as a rock star, the numbers, again, kind of cutting back to the Illinois comparison, Illinois ranked third, and Wisconsin is placed 42 in the most recent Bloomberg Economic Evaluation of States Index. So I think it's an interesting situation, because while those particular stories of one person committing crimes is bad, and Scott Walker can do his best attempts to spin himself away from that person, even though they vacation together, they have history, long history together. In the end, I believe the voters will look at the fact that the economy is not doing what Scott Walker promised it would do under his reforms. Drastic, legal, not legal, however you want to describe them, but he made major changes and he promised that those will lead to results. Well, the record shows, and people's wallets show, and even if Rockford Register Star says that Scott Walker touts Wisconsin financial successes in Illinois, we know that's just not true.
In Illinois, knows it's not true, too. They had a media call with different people from Illinois and people from Wisconsin talking. And Illinois people kept saying, please don't come down here. Please leave your stuff up in Wisconsin. Just stay there. We don't want it. It's not working. Ours is. And Illinois has created some of the most jobs in the nation, and Wisconsin has lost the most jobs in the nation.
While we're in Wisconsin, I'm perfectly happy to have Scott Walker stay in Illinois. Isn't that ironic?
Well, right. He could go travel all he wants, just please don't come back. That seems to be the sentiment I hear. Well, we
do not
get...
sign any more legislation. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, please, we have over 285 legislation bills already signed. Please do not sign any more. We have enough. Do you have anything pressing going on for next week at all? Because we got to get going.
I think it's just great that you're going to have Dorothy Nickelberg on your show, because I've been working with Dorothy as far as being part of the rally that's going to be in Madison on April 28th in support of women's rights. And Dorothy has done an amazing job, and it's going to be a huge rally, and I'm very honored to be part of it and just want to make sure that everybody shows up.
Well, I plan on being there. I hope everyone else is too. So thank you so much, Yuri, for being on. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds great, Sarah. Take care.
All right. Yep. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. And we'll be right back, and we'll have Malin Mitchell, who is running for lieutenant governor. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Scott Walker's recall election is just 7 weeks away, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Here in Wisconsin, it's a referendum not only on whether public sector workers have the right to bargain collectively, it's also a referendum on open government, free speech, public education, tenants' rights, women's rights, badger care, and the environment. It's about whether Wisconsin will honor its progressive history, epitomized by fighting Bob La Follette, or whether it will sink back into the swamp that produced Joe McCarthy. It's about whether the people, organized as never before at the grassroots level, can overcome the power of big money. If the people win, there'll be one big party in Madison. But if money wins, if the Koch brothers win, if Scott Walker wins, psychiatrists better start ordering antidepressants by the truckload, because it would have an enormously deflating effect on the tens of thousands of people who've worked so hard to try to restore a semblance of democracy and decency to the state. Nationally, it'd have a huge impact as well. If Walker loses, other right-wing governors will know that they'll pay a price for overreaching. If Walker wins, however, it's open season on public sector workers, public education, and any last flickering items on the progressive agenda. June 5th is the day. Mark your calendars. Much depends on the outcome. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz, and on now I have Malin Mitchell, who is running for lieutenant governor and is the president of the Firefighters Association. Is it out in Madison or is it statewide, Malin?
It is actually statewide. We represent 57 communities and over 3,000 firefighters.
Okay. And I wanted to thank you so much for being on today. I've been trying to get you on. Oh, you're welcome. I've been trying to get you on forever, and I'm so excited that you're on now.
No, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a busy time, that's no doubt, but we're all busy.
Oh, well, and I'm glad that you are running and it's nice to see you out there doing that. But why did you decide to run for lieutenant governor?
Well, you know, I always said from the beginning of this thing, once my name was been thrown around for running for anything, that I just want to do whatever it would take to move the state forward. And whatever position I could play in that is what I want to do. And, you know, with the governors, people, a lot of people ask me, well, why not governor? And I said from the get-go as well that I don't want to didn't want to muddy the water, so to speak. I don't want our primary here against Governor Walker to look like the Republican presidential primary. I think that we need to keep focused, make sure we stay in tune with what's at stake, and also keep our eyes on the prize, so to speak, and that is to get rid of Governor Walker. So I want us to all coalesce around whoever that person that comes out of the primary is and make sure we defeat Scott Walker, because that's what this recall is all about.
Well, what difference do you believe you can make?
Well, I think lieutenant governor, a lot of people say, what does lieutenant governor do? And I always ask the question when I go around the state, does anybody know what the lieutenant governor does? And I got an answer the other day, a young lady said, well, I think the lieutenant governor's job is to wake up and check the pulse of the governor every morning. But I think that the lieutenant governor's job can be so much more than that. I want to work on a couple of things, three things. I want to work on education. I think we have a governor who takes $1.6 billion away from the educational system, gives more money to the private school voucher system, takes 30% cut in tech colleges, and in the same breath, he says that his reforms are working and that we have an untrained workforce right now, that there are jobs out there, but we have an untrained workforce. So his answer was, of course, to take $71 million from MATC and our tech college system. And then I want to talk about jobs. We have a governor who created or promised to create 250,000 jobs in the next 6 months. Well, we've seen nothing but six straight months of job losses, and numbers just came out yesterday that we lost 4,300 jobs. So we got to really talk about real sustainable job creation, and not just any job, but a job where someone can support a family if they choose to and support themselves, obviously. So we need to bring community, we need to bring businesses to the table, corporations, as well as both sides, both houses, in order to really talk about real job growth. Last thing I want to talk about is poverty. We have a lot of elected officials that go around the state, but they're not talking about poverty. And it's not the sex issue, so to speak, that gets people excited or gets people thinking. But poverty right now is a huge problem in our state. In just the last year, we've had a 17% increase in children living in poverty. There are two zip codes in Milwaukee that make up over 60% of incarcerated individuals in our state. So we have a huge problem. And I'm just as guilty as anyone. Talking about the middle class and how middle class wages are under attack, how the middle class is being going down. But we don't think about people living in impoverished levels and what's happening to them. So we have this constant race to the bottom right now, and we got to stop it. We can do so much better than that. And we don't just live in an economy, but we live in a society. And a job of society is to take care of all. So that's the difference I think I can make. And also bringing some excitement and some energy, I think, to our base, because I am not a career politician. A lot of people say that, but I never saw myself running for any type of position, not even school board or anything. I always saw myself being a firefighter and, of course, being fortunate enough to be elected by my peers to be state president is probably about as far as I thought I would go as far as politics go.
How do you see sustainable jobs dovetailing with reducing poverty?
Well, I think if you throw education in there as well. I think if someone has a job, obviously, first of all, a lot of people think just because someone doesn't have a job, that they don't want one. That's not the case. We have a 51% African-American male joblessness rate in our state. So 51% of African-American males are not working. Now, some would say, well, they don't want to work. Well, that's not the case. I go into the neighborhoods. The last couple of weeks, I've been in the inner city of Milwaukee, and I'm talking to people that want to work, that can't find a job. And a lot of it sometimes because they don't have the education. But a lot of it, too, because the jobs aren't there. So once we can educate a lot of our members in the state, a lot of our people in the state, our community, that we can get these jobs. And I think getting people out of poverty, obviously they need jobs to be able to do that, and a living wage jobs that can help them support a family. Because everybody thinks that because of someone's plot in life that they immediately want that plot in life. Well, it's just not the case. It's not as easy as someone just saying, pick yourself up by your bootstraps. It's just not that easy for everybody. So we got to recognize that. The only way to do that is actually get in these communities, talk to the people, and see what services that we can give them or what they need to help themselves in their plot in life.
Well, you mentioned Milwaukee being one section of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee does have a problem with poverty. Is that one of the first places you're going to look at? I mean, we have places all over that are having some poverty issues, but Milwaukee's one of the bigger ones. Is that one of your focus areas, or are you just going to say, what can we do to the areas around? Because what you would need in Milwaukee as an urban area, it's going to be something different that you're going to need in some of the poor areas in the rural areas in Wisconsin.
Right, and I've been to rural areas. I've been to Darlington, Wisconsin. I've been to Hudson, Minocqua, Marinette. There are definitely areas, and when I talk about poverty, I'm not just talking about Milwaukee. I'm not just talking about Madison, Kenosha, Racine. I'm talking about the rural areas as well. So there are different tools, obviously. I hate to use the word tools, but there are different tools that you need in different areas, and you got to be able to curtail your message to the different districts that you're talking to. But that's why you go talk to the community leaders, and that's why the community, whether it be the Black community, African-American community, or whether you're in Hudson and it'd be the community leaders up there, that you actually talk to the community leaders and see what's really going on. I don't think you automatically know everything once you're elected to be a lieutenant governor or a governor. So you still have to work with community, and you can't lose that touch with reality. The reality is that we have a huge problem in the state, and we gotta work on it.
Now, Republicans are always quick to point Milwaukee as what is wrong with Wisconsin, but what plans do they have to improve Milwaukee schools and create jobs?
I haven't heard any yet. I know they gave more money. They took some money from the private school voucher system, which they don't, and they gave $300 million more to the private school voucher system, but then cut, you know, in Milwaukee, they cut $84.6 million a year from public education for Milwaukee. I mean, getting rid of the train, which was going to bring hundreds of jobs to Talgo in Milwaukee. More industry coming to Milwaukee. Of course, now Talgo is not going to be building trains out of Milwaukee. So there's manufacturing leaving the state. So I don't know what plan they have. I don't know if they even think about Milwaukee as being important, but I think the biggest city in any state, as the city goes, the state goes as well. So definitely Milwaukee utilizes a lot of resources, but we got to make sure we give them the right resources so that we can get Milwaukee thriving again. And then the rest of the state, I think, will come along with that. So I haven't heard a plan that they have. I don't know if you have one or heard one that they have.
Other than the mining bill, I actually have not. And I wasn't too certain that the mining bill would help Milwaukee, but that's all they were saying is that get the mining bill passed and there'll be jobs in Milwaukee. I found that to be a little interesting logic on their part. Now, they also believe that voucher and charter schools are the answers to Milwaukee's ills. And obviously you don't stand in that court.
No, that's asinine. What they're trying to do is publicize schools or privatize schools and take away public education. And all that's going to do is again, have this constant race to the bottom where the people that are living in lower tiers of society in Milwaukee are not going to have a proper education. That's what that's going to do.
So you're actually advocating resources versus the phony tools and supporting the corporations.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that we need corporations and that we need businesses in this state to thrive. There's no doubt that I'd love to bring more corporations in the state. That's one thing me and Walker probably do agree on. We do need more corporations in the state. But you know what we need is more good industry, more good corporations in the state. And the problem with it, as far as I'm concerned, is not corporations. The problem is we have politicians that are beholden to bad CEOs that own these corporations. So we need more industry in the state for job creation, job growth. There's no doubt about that. But giving tax breaks to corporations and then automatically assuming that's going to transcend into job growth and job creation has got to stop. We've seen that doesn't work. We've had six straight months of job losses. After last year, Scott Walker brought back the Las Vegas loophole, the multi-state corporation loophole, where you can make money in Wisconsin, but you can claim your taxes in Las Vegas or Colorado or wherever it's cheaper. And then he brings the "we are open for business" mantra, where you can come into the state, bring a company. Now, you don't have to bring a company in the state that creates jobs for people that live in Wisconsin. You can bring a company from Illinois and bring 20 people over the border and bring 20 people that worked in Rockford, and all you got to do now is drive to Beloit. So, but you still have 2 years not paying any income on any tax on the income you make. So those days have got to be over. If we're going to give a corporation somewhat of a tax break, first thing is you put an onus on them or accountability for them to create jobs here in Wisconsin, here in the state. And I'd even like to take it one step further. I'd like to see them train some people that are not trained to do those jobs here in the state. That right there will help poverty. Two, you don't give tax breaks to corporations and not make them accountable to getting jobs, and then balance the budget on the backs of the hardworking citizens of the middle class of the state. And that's the problem we have. I look at, you know, we call it rich and wealthy now. Everybody calls them a job creator. Republicans are good at messaging. Kind of like what you said. I mean, they have that senseless rhetoric. Their messaging is very, very good. But they call every rich and wealthy person a job creator. Well, not everybody that's rich and wealthy is a job creator. Nothing wrong with being rich and wealthy, but they're not all job creators. Back in the 19th century, they called them the robber barons. But we need to have more money in the middle class pocket, because the middle class is what, to me, are really the job creators. Because the more money that the middle class has is the more money that we spend. The more money we spend, the more goods and services that we use, the more goods and services that need to be in turn produced. Once those are produced more, then obviously they need to create more jobs. But we need industry in the state. We need some good corporations in our state to get our job growth working again, to put Wisconsin back to work again, as they always say, but to do it in a real manner.
So you would be for putting something in a bill with bringing in businesses that say 50% of your workforce has to be from the state of Wisconsin, and 10% of that must be trained workforce or people that you're going to train to get into your workforce. So would you be supportive of throwing that kind of language into bills?
Something to that matter. And again, I'll take it one step further. I'd say you need more people that do not have the training. There's a lot of people at tech colleges right now changing careers because their career has gone outside of the state. So I would look at a coalition between tech colleges and any corporation that comes in the state as far as training goes. I mean, we used to do on-the-job training. Whatever happened to that? I mean, you don't hear anybody with any on-the-job training programs whatsoever in the state or anywhere, actually in the nation, really. So I would be all for, okay, if the state's going to help subsidize some of your corporation, if we're going to actually give you money from that the state's giving you, and I'm not talking about the CAPCOs because that's horrible. I'm saying if we're going to give you some money, you need to have some accountability to the state. We need some of that money coming back into the community, and that is, like you said, by having some job training programs as well as making them accountable to hiring people in our state, not bringing 300 people from Minnesota, Illinois, and saying, look, we created 300 jobs in Wisconsin. That just doesn't work. The numbers work, but that's not real job creation. And that's what we're saying.
Can you okay, let me rephrase this. How would you work with WEAC and other unions to improve Wisconsin?
You got to bring labor to the table. And I'll be the first to admit that sometimes we as labor, and I put my labor association in with this just like everyone else, we were somewhat stagnant for a while. We took a lot of things for granted. I think that's why some of the reason why we're here today. But we're ready, armed, and equipped right now, and ready to get back to work. And I think we went from a point of just servicing our members to actually now we got to educate and mobilize our members. And we have to do it. So I think another step to that is being at the table, being part of the solution. Not that we weren't before, but now we really got to really make a concentrated effort, a concerted effort to be part of the solution and work with whoever our employers, work with the school districts, work with the state in order to make the state better. We can all do this together, but unions are going to have to be at the table. So I definitely think that, like the WEACs and the AFSCMEs and the Firefighters Association, the Police Officers Associations need to work with the government, and we do that. And that's what collective bargaining really is. That's what we've been doing for years. There's just a misnomer about what collective bargaining is, and a lot of people don't understand it. But a lot of Republicans, I believe, do understand it, and that's why they would get rid of it, because it did help all, and it did look out for all employees.
Now, if people want more information on your campaign, where can they go?
They can go to MahlonMitchell.com. It's M-A-H-L-O-N. Last name is Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L.com. Our website's there, and you can go volunteer. You can always donate if you like, and then as well as find out more information about me and how you can get in contact with the campaign as well.
Well, Mahlon, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. I know you've got a crazy busy schedule, and I appreciate the time.
Well, thank you for having me. Good to talk to you, sir.
Yep, you have a good day now.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks. That was Mahlon Mitchell. He is running for lieutenant governor. And again, his website, if you'd like more information, is MahlonMitchell.com. So coming up next, we will be speaking with Edna Conkle and Dorothy Mickelberg about the We Are Women March on April 28th. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show.
Waiting your time, dreaming of a better life. Waiting your time.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. And now I have Edna Conkle and Dorothy Mickelberg from the We Are Women March. They are the organizers for the march in Wisconsin. I'd like to welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Sarah.
Love that song, by the way.
Isn't that a great song? It's one of my favorite songs. It's a song by Peter Gabriel called Shaking the Tree, and it's one of my favorite songs that he did.
That's going on my favorite playlist for woman songs.
Well, I picked it out. I told you guys earlier, but I'll let everyone know. I actually picked it out specifically for you guys and for the march. I find it a very uplifting song, and I feel that that's what this march is about.
Excellent.
I would agree. So.
Edna, you want to talk a little bit about how it sort of got started?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, let's talk about Unite Women first, because that's the group that it's kind of the umbrella group it's under. Let's talk about that for a second and talk about how that got started, and we'll go into how you guys got into the march and into the organization.
Great.
Sure. I'm Edna speaking right now, and the organization started on February 19th by two friends who were having a discussion. They were listening to all the legislations that were being proposed and passed in a variety of states, and specifically they were concerned about the transvaginal legislation proposed in Virginia, and decided it was time for them to do something about it. And so they were talking and they were talking and they were talking, and they said, well, you know, what can we do? And basically they decided that they were going to try to see about getting a group to get groups together to march on capitals. And so they started a Facebook group. And the founder, Karen Teagarden, is in Michigan, and her friend Desi is in New York. So they started, I believe, just one Facebook group to start off with. And in, you know, an overnight's worth of time, with people inviting friends and things like that, it quickly ballooned to about 500 people overnight You know, they went and they put it up at 9 o'clock at night, and they saw 500 people by the next day, and they decided that they needed to do more. So as the days went by, they decided to open groups like this, and Facebook groups in each of the states, and see what kind of, you know, what kind of response that they would get. And I have to admit, I didn't sign on the 19th through the 20th. I think I believe I started on the 26th of February. I came into the group that was the Wisconsin group, and I don't even remember what friend invited me into that group, because I don't think I would have just fallen upon it. And there were 600 people already in there. There was some, there was the typical, you know, I want to volunteer, but I don't know how to get going. And as a person who has a little bit, not enough patience with that, I said, okay, well, what are we doing? Where are we going to go? What do we want to do with this? And spent that first weekend trying to increase our membership numbers by getting people to invite their friends to the group, and then finding out more from the national group exactly what the expectations were for these kinds of marches and where we could go from there. So pretty much since that last week of February, I've been doing a lot of volunteer work with this group, initially at both the state and national levels, but more recently just sticking with the Wisconsin group, and trying to engage volunteers and get people aware of all the things that are going on in our own state and across the nation through news stories on Facebook, posting them on Facebook pages, sharing them with people, getting people's opinions, trying to get them involved and understand that all of the stuff that's happening here in Wisconsin is going to filter down and affect them in their own personal lives, whether it's affecting their daughters or granddaughters in the future, or their wives or their mothers, or, you know, their grandmothers, because the kinds of legislations that are being put out there under, you know, the auspices of just like normal legislation, when you look at it and you see that there's been hundreds, literally the Guttmacher Institute says there's over 800 specific legislations that are related to women or reproductive health since 2011, you sit back and wonder and say, I wonder how many specific legislations are related to men's health. And you look, and the only ones that come up are the ones that are retaliatory legislation to bring attention to the fact that no one's saying anything about things that are related to men's health. No one's saying, oh, well, you know, if you want to use Viagra, you have to go through these 12 hoops in order to get this medication. No, you get this as part of your prescription medication, and you get to use it, you know, as long as your doctor prescribes it, and you don't have to go through a rigorous examination before or after you use it to verify that you know what you're doing when you're using it. On the other hand, when it comes down to women's reproductive health and birth control and those kinds of things, people want to jump in and say, hey, you know, you're not smart enough to figure out how to deal with your own reproductive organs, so we're going to figure out, we're going to tell you exactly what you need to do, and, you know, we're going to be ask for invasive procedures that aren't even recommended by board-certified obstetricians and gynecologists. So we're in a really weird place in our world right now.
We are. We very much are. And as far as the Viagra is concerned, it was about a month after it came out that it was put on to insurances. So you can get insurance. You can get insurance with no problem. And we're still fighting on. We as in women are still trying to get birth control on, even though it's used as a medication in many instances. Dorothy, what brought you to the march, and what got you interested in being one of the organizers?
Well, as Edna pointed out, her history in getting involved, my involvement was much the same. Started hearing about this march that was going to happen, Then I was invited into the group, actually by Chris Taylor, a representative assemblywoman that's working really hard for us in our state assembly here in Wisconsin. So I sort of landed in the same group in Facebook. Edna was very kind to be the initial contact, and I jumped in just as a volunteer to fill the gaps and just all those little details about getting an event together, and then took on responsibilities to help Edna as far as a state liaison to our national group, Unite Women. And I will add, Sarah, just to what Edna was saying about it, this sprung up February 19th. That's, what, just 2 months ago here. And the phenomenal rate that this caught on over the country. Edna, I was looking at documents a little bit earlier today, and I did an informal count. I believe it's 38 states now that will have events at their state capitals, varying from small event, you know, small groups with a speaker to, I think, in California, they've got Holly Near that's going to be at their event, and so forth. My point is, though, that it's taken off like wildfire. And why? Because in the reason I got into it is because we are outraged. We're absolutely outraged with the legislation that Edna was outlining that is attacking our fundamental rights. It's not just badly thought out policy. It's a concerted effort, a social statement about women. It's an attack on women. I also come to this as a former advocate, legal advocate in Washington State for victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. So I have a professional history, too, that I identify a lot of what's going on. I think there's been a couple of good articles out there in Chicago and I think even the New York Times about how this attack, and it's a legislative attack that's happening, and let's just call it what it is, by Republicans, for the most part, on fundamental rights of women. But when they talk about, you know, when we see this legislative attack, the profile of the impetus that's coming from us, I identified to my days as a domestic violence advocate with the characteristics and a profile of a batterer. Except for now, we have it on a big, huge group level, which we've never seen anything like this. Or have we? I don't know. So I guess that's what brought me to this. This is an all-out attack on women. We see it in so many ways. We see it when women do speak out, tell their own stories to try and get attention to it in the media. The young woman that testified in Congress, and she was immediately attacked in mainstream media by Republican mouthpiece in the most vile way. That's pretty analogous to what I would see with a batterer in my days of assessing and working with victims. Batterers lashing out, blaming the victim, demeaning them, rude, vile name calling, which is what that boiled down to. The traits are just, they're frightening, really. So I guess you'd say that's what brings me personally. But as far as what I've seen grown with this organization, it's taken off like wildfire. Women across this nation are getting their voices, and they want to be heard now. No more. Stop. Enough is enough. That's the mantra of this group, of enough is enough, but we've heard it in a lot of places. So I think this group is great. It's achieved a lot of what it set out to do in just finding the network of other women of like mind across the nation that we can join collectively and not just be standing alone, isolated, and saying no more.
Well, what kind of response are you getting from the Republican independent women? Are they just as concerned as this cutting through all political ideology?
You know, and just anecdotal sort of as I talk to people, there are many Republican women that are just as aghast at this attack. Republican women use contraception. Republican, you know, equal pay. I don't meet a lot of Republican women that are just fine with not receiving equal pay to men. You know, we make 78 cents on a dollar here in Wisconsin. But again, intimidation tactics have kept a lot of people quiet. We're going to be fortunate to have a speaker at our rally that is one of the courageous and brave Republican women that's willing to stand up and say, no, this isn't right. This isn't my party. So, you know, it crosses all political, you know, socioeconomic lines. But as far as legislative attack on women, it's Republican.
Now, what kind of response are you getting from the younger women, women who are 40 and under, and how about the women of color as well?
40 and under, I think one of the ways we're getting a lot of responses, because the main tool that has been used here, which I find a real miracle, you know, I'm sure there's a sociologist out there somewhere studying this, that this took off so well on Facebook, which you're going to find, and I forget what the statistics are, but I know it's the majority of users on Facebook are women. I think it's something like 64%. And they do tend to use more of the sharing features. So and they're also younger. So we get a lot more women involved and empowered with information to find out what's going on both nationally and in their own areas. So I think this whole movement is, you know, accomplishing, you know, it's starting or it's setting the seeds for getting that information out to younger women and empowering them to take control and use their voice. And as far as women of color, we've reached out. We do have some really great speakers that are going to be at the rally representing the Hispanic community as well as Native American community in Wisconsin. This affects everybody. This, you know, it isn't any particular, you know, it just crosses the board.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the march and rally. We have about 5 minutes left. So, Edna, can you talk? I know it goes fast, doesn't it?
So, it does go fast. I have so much more to say. No.
Time flies when you're having fun, right?
Well, you both will be on next week as well. We'll give a little update as before the march next Saturday. But, Edna, can you talk a little bit about who's going to be there and what all you've got planned? Because I know you mentioned Chris Taylor, and I know she's emceeing the event. So let's talk about more some of the other things going to be there. It's a two-hour event. What time it is?
Sure. Well, we're going to officially be starting at 1 o'clock and running things till about 3 o'clock. We've got a strong group of speakers, but we will also have some entertainment. So because it's Crazy Legs weekend and, you know, Farmers Market on Saturday, we want to make sure that people get there in time. We're expecting lots and lots of people there, so we want to make sure that you can get to where you need to be. We're on the South Hamilton Street side of the Capitol building, so that's where we'll be aggregating at the time. Again, yes, Chris Taylor will be our MC for the event, and then we will have other assembly persons, including Jocasta Zamarripa, or Joey Z, as we like to say, because it's a lot easier to remember. And we've got Mark Pocan and Kelda Helen Royes, who are all from the Assembly. We've got Rob Zerbin, who's a candidate for Congress running against Paul Ryan. And we've got Yuri Rashkin from Janesville, who is a candidate for Assembly and a just recently retired Janesville City Council member. So we've got that group. We've got a woman named Dee Ives, who's a former Air Force vet woman. She's also a nurse, and she's the woman that is the Republican person who wants to, you know, talk about what's happened to her party. And let's see, we've got Sarah Finger, who is the executive director for Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health. And we've got Kathy Utley, who's She works at the Goodman Community Center in Madison as the food resource manager. So she's going to be talking about food security issues that women and elderly women have. That is one of the things that is, not broached often in topics. And we've got Gwen Carr is our Native American woman activist, and she's a matriarch in that arena, and so she'll be speaking on a number of issues in there. We've got Reverend Stephen Welsh, who is from the Wisconsin Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. We wanted to make sure that we pulled together a program that was broad and covered a lot of territory, including people of, that have religious beliefs that see that, reproductive choice is part of that realm. And then we've got we've got some authors in there who are also very good speakers. We've got Ruth Conniff, who is a writer for the Progressive magazine. And then our keynote speaker will be John Nichols, who's well-known across the country as a political blogger and Washington correspondent for The Nation, and is also one of the associate editors at the Capital Times. So we've got a broad program, and then we've got some entertainers, and we'll have the Raging Grannies there doing a set of songs for us. We'll be having the Pipers lead us in and out of the program, and we've got a few surprises up our sleeve that we're not sharing just yet. Did I miss anything, Dorothy?
I think you got it there, Edna. It's going to be great.
It sounds like it's going to be phenomenal. So you guys have done an amazing job of organizing. Everyone's a volunteer organizer, correct?
Oh, yeah.
And
this is grassroots as it gets.
Okay, and just to be
you know clear, what I think I missed saying Mark Pocan's name, and that would be terrible to miss somebody's name as a speaker. So,
and you've got some phenomenal speakers. He's a great speaker. John Nichols is a great speaker. But you are meeting at the Capitol, correct? The South Hamilton entrance at the Capitol.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, just making sure everyone got that. And you'll be on next week again to talk a little bit more about it right before?
I would love to be back.
Okay, and in between that time, where can people go to get more information about the march?
Okay, well, you can easily go. The place that's easiest to find and to get to all the places where you need to go would be our website, and that is unitewomenwi.org, which would be unitewomenwi.org, and that will that has links that will help lead you to our Facebook group page, our Facebook community page. If you would like an email event reminder, you can get that there. So it's kind of a one-stop shop instead of giving you 12 URLs.
Right. Well, thank you guys so much for being on. I appreciate the time, and we'll talk with you next week. And thank you so much for putting the time into doing this. I think it's going to be an amazing rally.
Thank you so much for inviting us, Sarah.
You're welcome. Have a great week now.
All right. You too.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. That was Dorothy Mickelberg and Edna Conkle, and they are the organizers, the grassroots organizers of the We Are Women March from UniteWomen.org. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. After this short break, we'll have Liz DiNovella from The Progressive and Whitney from the Citizens Co-op. Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. Now I have Liz DiNovella from the Progressive Magazine and Whitney from the Wisconsin Citizen Media Co-op, and we're going to be discussing the American for Prosperity. Now, before we go on, good morning, guys, by the way, I want to say.
Good morning. It's great to be here, as always.
Oh, it's great to have you back on again, Liz, and good morning, Whitney. Thank you for calling in.
Good morning.
And being on. So, now, you both were at the American for Prosperity event, and actually, before we go into it more, I don't know if it's Liz or Whitney want to talk more about what American for Prosperity is, just in case there's some people who kind of heard of it but don't really know about this group.
Sure. Do you want to go ahead, Whitney, or do you...
You probably know more than I would.
Sure. Americans for Prosperity is one of these groups that gets, you know, set up by, you know, big funders. It's kind of like it's a right-wing think tank in a way. And it was started by the oil billionaires, David Koch, who's famous from his Koch Industries, and another fellow named Richard Fink. They have been involved with some Tea Party efforts also. Many of the folks who attended the Americans for Prosperity group, which people call AFP for short, have been, a lot of people who are at the Wisconsin group were also seem also to be somewhat involved with local Tea Party efforts also. So what the Americans for Prosperity do, they're a group, they're, you know, kind of like a think tank, and what they do, they put out messages that are in line with David Koch and other wealthy business and their interests. So they, you know, oppose labor unions and healthcare reform, and they oppose cap and trade legislation, stuff like that.
And
that
so
helps. It's a
yeah, mm-hmm. No, it, you're good. You're good. So they sponsor these meetings, rallies. I'm not sure what you would want to call where you guys are at. Well, what would you guys call it? A rally, a meeting, a
right.
Teaching, I'm not sure what it would be.
I guess one thing I want to say, too, is that this think tank, Americans for Prosperity, it was one of the lead organizations behind the Tax Day Tea Party protest in April of 2009. And so I think it was really with this, and that was the Tax Day protest that really sort of launched the Tea Party movement nationally. So what I would say we were at in Wisconsin was, I would call it a Wisconsin conference, it was a chance for people to sort of rally the troops to get excited about, you know, what's going on here in Wisconsin from a conservative point of view. I think what was really interesting, what I saw, was this disconnect between the people who were on the stage, who were mainly out-of-towners, people from D.C., versus the people who were in the crowd, most of whom seemed to be from the Milwaukee area, but not everybody. The conference was held you know, right across from Mitchell Airport in Milwaukee. And so there was this disconnect between, who, you know, all these people talking about what's going on in Wisconsin and, you know, many people who were leading these sort of workshops were, you know, from Washington, D.C., and the people in the crowd were from Wisconsin. So I think that's always interesting to see when, you know, when you're talking about what kind of local presence Americans for Prosperity have in Wisconsin, you know, look at who's on stage and then who's in the crowd, that sort of disconnect.
Whitney, what did you see while you were there? What was your impression of it?
I wasn't there for very long, but there were a lot of people just I don't know. It was very interesting to sit in the crowd and listen to people. There was a man sitting in front of us who was talking to his son about how terrible liberals are, and just we saw all these conservative I was there with a friend, so we saw all these conservative politicians around, and saw Jeff Fitzgerald walking out on the way in, and, you know, just, I don't know, it was, you know, there was,
It was a mix of people there then?
Yeah.
And what other politicians were there other than Jeff Fitzgerald? Was he there because he was running for Senate? Was that why he was there?
I guess we got there just as he was leaving. Like, we saw him walking out of the parking lot, basically. But I saw Robin Voss, Glenn Grossman, Alberta Darling, Van Wangard, and Ron Johnson was taking pictures with people near us for a while.
Well, yeah, you got your picture with him, didn't you?
Yeah, that was fun.
Representative Pridemore was also there, and Rebecca Clefish. And I think it's important to keep in mind, this was also in the weeks leading up to the Wisconsin Republican primary. So you also had Rick Santorum visiting, and, you know, so it really was sort of a local and national sort of scene.
Well, and you talked to Senator Pridemore, Liz, and what interests me is his reaction about Santorum, because he had mentioned that Rick Santorum is there, but I really wish more candidates would have shown up. And to me, I found that to be an interesting response. A lot of people who were there were very much in love with Rick Santorum, is my understanding of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think people, they were very excited by Santorum. And, you know, Santorum, when he gave his speech, he was saying, you know, moderates don't win. You know, and it's time for people to stand up for what you believe in, and that the people in Wisconsin should vote for somebody authentic. And, you know, Santorum said that he was going to do well in rural areas. And it's true, you know, he did do very well in rural areas, even though he won in the city of Madison because of the open primary system that we have. But I think the Santorum speech about don't nominate moderates, moderates don't win, really was well received by the crowd, because it is a crowd that, you know, was more conservative.
And what were you both there for? Liz, were you there because, I mean, did Matt force you to show up, or was it, you were at CPAC, was it interesting to see the difference between the two? What brought you out there?
Well, I went because I'm very interested in the conservative movement here in Wisconsin. I think, you know, I want to understand why Walker has such high poll ratings, even, you know, leading up to this recall election. So I'm very curious to hear how people form their arguments, what they say, and I think it's also important to know how conservatives are sort of framing the debate, how they see things, because I think it's very easy, at least, and I don't know, Whitney may have a completely different impression, but I think it's easy to be an outsider or be from the Progressive magazine and say, oh, look at AFP, they are funded by the Koch brothers, therefore it's all about what the Koch brothers are doing. Yet when you're actually there, I didn't really hear anybody talking about the Koch brothers. And so it's also interesting to see how Wisconsin has become this national issue. And I really think that an important part of the presidential election this year is going to be slugged out here in the Midwest. I think that the Republicans are going to be posturing themselves as being, you know, nice Midwesterners who are level-headed, you know, people like Paul Ryan, who, you know, has a lot of the national spotlight right now, and I think they're going to say, oh, and look at Obama and being, you know, from Chicago and the culture of corruption in Chicago. You know, those are the things I was expecting to hear a couple months ago, and those are exactly the sort of things that I heard at the Americans for Prosperity Conference in Wisconsin.
Whitney, what brought you out there?
Originally a friend would just posted somewhere on Facebook, is anybody going to this? And I just thought, well, this would be interesting to go to because I've never attended anything like this because I've never wanted to. But, you know, I looked more into it and, you know, I thought it would just be fun to go and listen to what they had to say, to just, I don't know, hear. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, to hear some of the things that they're saying, and or what was interesting about it?
Yeah, well, just to hear what they say, because I'm sure they don't, like, change their rhetoric when they're in front of, well, I'm sure they do, but just to see if they, like, how the certain, the speakers acted in front of the audience.
Were you uncomfortable there? Did you find the people there intimidating or the speakers there intimidating at all?
No, I was, I mean, at one point I was alone and, you know, I was a little uncomfortable, but nobody was really bothered me or anything, and so I was okay.
What brought that feeling of uncomfortability while you were there?
Well, I was just sitting alone in the crowd, and I knew, well, they didn't know I was different from them, but I knew that I was, and that just made me, I've wondered if I was giving off different vibes, but nobody really said anything to me at any point.
Like giving off the liberal progressive vibes?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Well, we're going to go to a break real fast. So, you guys, I'm going to put you guys a little bit on hold there. So we are speaking to Liz DiNovella from the Progressive Magazine and Whitney from the Wisconsin Citizens Media Co-op, and you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. Sarah Schultz, and we'll be right back.
Hello. This is Senate Democratic Leader Mark Miller. Why are Republican legislative leaders across the country attacking the rights of women? Governor Walker and legislative Republicans in Wisconsin are no exception. Over the last 18 months, they have enacted an extreme agenda attacking Wisconsin women like never before. Recently, Governor Walker signed several of these anti-women bills in a secret signing. Included was the bill to repeal Wisconsin's Equal Pay Enforcement Act. This bill essentially takes away the rights of women to challenge discrimination in the workplace. It is particularly ironic that Governor Walker signed this bill as we are recognizing National Pay Equity Day. Do we need to remind Republicans that women do not get equal pay for equal work? Do we need to remind them that it takes until April 17th of each year for a working woman to earn the wages a working man earned in the prior calendar year? And according to Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health, this pay disparity cost over $4,000 a year per household for Wisconsin families. Republicans also passed a bill that eliminated state and federal funding from Planned Parenthood health centers. These centers provide cancer screenings and preventive health care for thousands of Wisconsin women in underserved areas. Do we need to remind Republicans that their mothers, wives, and daughters benefit from cancer screenings and preventive health care? Additionally, Republicans passed a bill interfering with women and their doctor-patient relationship. Do Republicans really believe women shouldn't have a say over their health care? As a father of two daughters, a son, and a husband, I cannot stand idly by while women are attacked. I cannot stand idly by while we roll back the clock on women's progress toward equality. Restricting women's access to health care, health information, and even the suggestion that they should not get paid the same as men for the same work is preposterous. Every family in Wisconsin benefits when women are treated fairly in the workplace, have access to health care, and have evidence-based health information. We do a disservice to our families when these basic rights are threatened or taken away. We will continue to stand up against attacks on women.
And what did you think about today?
I really liked it. It was what I expected to hear today, very positive. The messages were solid, and I hope that a lot of what we heard today is spread around and that the word, the truth, gets out.
And what was the main message for you today?
The main message today is that the way things are currently going, we cannot continue down that path. There has to be some changes made. The changes aren't necessarily going to be popular. There's going to be maybe some pain involved, but those are the things that we have to do in order to make sure that the country is stable and viable for this generation and future generations.
What are you most excited about at this conference?
Well, the energy coming out of here today is much more than I would have expected, and I feel real good about that because this energy is going to be spread to other people as well, along with the message.
You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz, and what you just heard was an interview that Liz did to one of the people who was at American for Prosperity meeting in March. And he was talking about the messaging. Did you want to go in from there about some of the people you met real fast, Liz, before we talk about the sessions?
Sure. One thing that really struck me, and maybe it was because this was the talk, I believe the recording that I did right there was right after the main talk from Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan was the keynote. He was introduced by Michelle Malkin, who's a right-wing columnist. And I want to, before we get into that, I just want to point out that what an older crowd it was. You know, when they asked if anyone was 39 or younger, very few hands, less than 10% of hands went up. This is a crowd of a few hundred. So we had this older crowd there. And it was fascinating because Paul Ryan talked about, gobbledygook social welfare stuff, but he's saying this to a room of retirees who are living on Social Security. You know, so, but I think what really resonated with Paul Ryan's speech and with the interview that you just aired talked about was that people really think that, we're spending too much, we really need to make changes, and some of them might be painful, but it's sort of this moral correct thing to do. You know, it almost seems like the sort of being a family and we have to be on a budget and we all have to sacrifice. And it was sort of like some of the message that comes out. And I think that's what people really respond to.
Well, I understand, and we just mentioned it, that the AFP, American for Prosperity, held grassroots workshops. Can you explain how AFP describes grassroots?
How do they describe grassroots? I don't know exactly what you mean, but they definitely had a couple different workshops on how to message well, how to argue well. I went to a panel on social media, and that was very interesting. You know, they talked about citizen journalism and the stuff that everyone has a role to play. So I thought that was very interesting. One of the people who was on that panel was from the Franklin Center, which is another right-wing think tank. And, you know, he said point blank, we are in the midst of an info war. And there's this discussion, is this preaching to the choir or not? He's saying, no, we need the choir to do social media. You know, they really want folks in that room to go on the offensive and, to be citizen journalists, to make recordings. But, you know, and a little bit this came sort of out during this social media panel was that, you know, I don't think most people in that room use a lot of social media. I mean, when I checked the AFP hashtag for the event, you know, the Twitter hashtag, I mean, no, the only people who were tweeting were the people from D.C. who were on the panel. There was no one else in the room who was sort of doing, you know, who were putting out tweets, which is something you would normally see at conferences where people are very much engaged at the social media level while they're also present physically in a conference. So it was interesting to hear them talk about social media, but you know they were very clear about it. They said this is an information war. You know, to them it's about getting the message out. It's not about what the message is. It's because there's this certainty in the message. It's really about getting the message out. And in fact, the other thing they said that was interesting was that they compared the Occupy movement to the Tea Party movement, which I thought was sort of interesting.
That's an interesting comparison, isn't it?
Well, it is. They said, you know, they were saying that the Occupy, that the left needed a Tea Party, and so therefore they occupied the whole Occupy movement was manufactured. You know, and people argued that the Tea Party movement is manufactured, and you know, I think one of the reasons the Tea Party came about is precisely because the Republicans who had, you know, so dominated D.C. politics had lost the presidency. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons that it happened.
I seem to find that the messages that some of these right-wing think tanks put out are describing what the left is doing is actually describing what the right is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they came out and said Occupy is manufactured is actually saying the Tea Party is manufactured. And at the beginning, I don't think it was. I think it was taken over. But it seems to be part of their messaging is that we're going to tell you what we're doing, but we're going to tell you that the other person's doing it. So when the left comes out and says, oh, it's manufactured, the right can go, oh, no, you're manufactured and you're just telling us that.
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean, they talk about how the left uses deception tactics, and this one person says the left uses deception tactics. All we have to do is show that they are outside of the mainstream, you know. And these are the same people who are just worshiping Andrew Breitbart and all the sort of like nonsense, gotcha, so-called journalism that they do, where they, you know, do a recording and selectively edit and, you know, get people to lose their jobs, like in the case of the agricultural department where that poor woman lost her job because of, you know, how a tape was edited. So, in a way, what you're saying is totally right, you know.
And the other thing I found interesting what you said is that they are not asking what the message is, they're just saying, get it out. On the left, we seem to be going, well, what's our message? The right's going, here's your message. Now it's up to everyone else to push it.
Yeah, well, I think that's been the case for a while. I think that the right has always been much better at being lockstep in message. And I think that the left has, different ideas about what to do. So I think that that's, I don't know if it's always going to be the case, but it's definitely not something new.
Now, I want to get back to the grassroots question real fast.
Mm-hmm.
We consider grassroots to be from the bottom up, that this is the people stepped up. Like in Madison, a lot of the protests were grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
You see the Occupy is a grassroots. It was organic and started from the ground up. Is that the way you feel that they're using the term grassroots with Americans for Prosperity when they use the term? Or do you feel that they're using the term and putting another definition to it?
That's a really interesting question. I think that what happens sort of on both sides is that you do have sort of this grassroots movement of, you know, on all sides you have people in Wisconsin in the past year who have become politically engaged in ways that they hadn't before. And I think there is going to be a tendency on both sides to sort of have these more established groups to try to sort of like take them over and, you know, sort of like use that energy. So I think that there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who are conservative who would agree with AFP's ideas, even if AFP wasn't here. But I really don't. What's unclear to me is what comes out of that conference. Like, it's unclear to me if there are a bunch of different, you know, people got together and formed new groups in their local communities based out of AFP. I don't know if that sort of like movement building came out of that particular conference or if it was just more of a like get people together to get excited for the primary. So I would have to sort of figure out and talk to people about.
Okay.
I mean, what do you think? You think that there is, that they use grassroots differently is my impression.
Oh, I was curious what your opinion was on it. I feel that that both sides tend to frame words a certain way, and I feel that the right may frame it differently than the left frames it. So when they say the term grassroots,
uh-huh.
that the left is, you know, they're using one definition. And what's curious to me is if the people who follow the same ideology use the same definition as what AFP uses for grassroots. And that's my curiosity. Since they're mm-hmm. defining grassroots, are we using the same definition, or is AFP using a different definition, still using the word, so people are thinking it one way and they're actually terming it another?
Right. That's a good question. Well, I definitely got the – but, again, like looking at this specific social media panel, you know, they were talking about how people need to use social media. But, again, most of the people in that crowd were, you know, 65 or over, and no one was tweeting, you know. So they encourage people to work together, but I really don't know what sort of came out of it. And I think if you're really trying to, like, foster a grassroots movement, you want to sort of set up those networks. But I think when you set up those networks, there's also the possibility to sort of, like, take it over. But I think that's what happens with movements, no matter what kind of movement they are.
That's true. It does have that tendency. We have about a minute left. So, Whitney, you wrote a great piece about your time at AFP. Can you tell people where they can go to read that?
The website is wcmcoop.com.
Will it be in the archives then? People can look that up?
Yeah.
Okay. And Liz, I'm sorry, go ahead, Whitney.
No, that's all.
Okay. Well, so, but your name is on there. So if you look under writers, I believe you can click Whitney and then her stuff will come up if I'm not mistaken. And Liz, you also wrote a really great article about your time at AFP. Where can people go to read that?
You can go to progressive.org, the website of the Progressive magazine. And my colleague Ruth Conniff was there also, so I think we have more than one piece up. But we've been doing a lot of coverage about what's going on here in Wisconsin, so you can check out progressive.org for more.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Whitney and Liz, for being on today. I appreciate it. We'll definitely have you guys on again. And, Liz, I want to have you come back and talk more about messaging and what's going on in Wisconsin with messaging and the right versus the left. I think that would be a really great conversation.
It would be. Thanks. So, have a good day.
Yep, you too. Thanks. Thank you, Whitney, for coming on. You have a good day now.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks. So that was Whitney from the Wisconsin Citizens Media Co-op, and we had Liz DiNovella from the Progressive Magazine. Coming up next, we're going to be talking to Scott Witkoff, Charles Uphoff, and Jan Moore, who will be discussing grassroots organization in Wisconsin. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? my daddy was a union man. Someday I'll be one too. The boss is fine, my daddy. What's the family gonna do? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. And on now with me is Scott Wickoff from Badger Democracy and Charles Uphoff with the Oregon Area Progressives. I'd like to welcome you both to the Sarah Schultz Show today, guys. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Sarah. Glad to be here.
Thanks.
And we're going to be talking about grassroots organizations. Now, Scott, you've talked about grassroots organization, and you've also, you're part of several grassroots organizations, and Charles, you have been doing this forever. How about, you know, before, oh my goodness, I was so amazed at how long you've been doing this. So actually, before we even go into that, can you give a little bit of your history on how long you've been in grassroots and some of the stuff you've done in your life? It's truly,
sure.
To me, it was amazing to read.
Well, I met my wife during the 1968 McCarthy campaign, presidential campaign, in Wisconsin, and served as a field organizer in Wisconsin, Indiana, Oregon, California, New York, Kansas, and got tear gassed in Chicago during the 1968 Democratic Convention. I've been involved with progressive politics and issues and campaigns for, it seems like, forever. And most recently, I've been very active with Oregon Area Progressives, which is a grassroots community group. We have a monthly, every month, open mic at the Firefly Coffee House in downtown Oregon, and would invite people who might have an interest to show up. It's the first Thursday of every month from 6 to 8 o'clock, and we have usually featured speakers along with music, poetry, sometimes storytelling, even a juggler on one occasion. We've had Senator Mark Miller, Kathleen Vinehout, John Nichols, Ben Mansky, Wisconsin Solidarity Singers, Raging Grannies, a whole bunch of groups that have been featured guests at our open mic, and it's been a really good tool for us to help sort of recreate a sense of community and pull people together, progressives, to talk about issues and avoid some of the burnout that sometimes comes with getting involved in long and extended campaigns.
And Scott, how about you talk about some of the stuff you've written about with grassroots, and you discuss some of the groups that you're with.
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to say it's an honor to be on the same conversation about grassroots as Charles. So thanks for that.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, you know, primarily I started blogging as a reaction to what Scott Walker did, because there's been a complete void and avoidance in the mainstream media about the reality of what the current GOP stands for. And as a side note, as I was listening to the conversation about Americans for Prosperity, I find it laughable that they consider what they're doing, and they can define it in any way, as grassroots. And I think anybody involved in the grassroots can agree that what they do is the antithesis of grassroots. What they do is – is controlled completely by a political organization and process and people at the very head of that organization and process. And that is exactly what this true grassroots movement is a reaction against. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was letting you usually there's a little bit more, but that's all right. We'll go on. And I just wanted to say, Scott, that's why when I read what Charles did, I was so amazed and honored that he wanted to come on that's why I asked him to talk about his history, because I think it's absolutely amazing. I had no idea when he said he'd be on. It was just great to hear. So I'm so excited that he's on as well. Now, you have a grassroots group, though, really fast. Why don't you talk about that before we go into some of the organizational parts of this?
Okay. Well, we're very new, and we've just formed, and we're calling it the Wisconsin Movement. And as we are structuring and creating our bylaws and organizational structure, and you're going to be hearing, I can't really discuss too much because obviously, when you're starting something like this, there's a lot of people involved in any true grassroots organization. There's a lot of people involved, and I can't speak for everybody. But as we present ourselves to the public and become active, it'll become clear how we're different and the type of void that we look to fill. And we are looking to become a statewide both clearinghouse and think tank for grassroots action all over the state. So working with groups like Oregon Progressives and United Wisconsin and any other grassroots organization at the local level for statewide action. And it's very exciting because as we move into the recall election and the candidate is selected and we all have to unify behind a candidate to defeat Scott Walker, the only hope against the corporate money and power is going to be the people. And that's what needs to be brought to bear against Scott Walker. And it's our hope to be at the basis of doing that. And then moving forward from the recall election after Scott Walker is defeated to taking back a progressive assembly and retaining a progressive Senate. So that's going to be the reason for our existence. And to continue forward moving a progressive grassroots agenda in Wisconsin.
If I could jump in.
Sure.
Yeah, Scott, I really appreciate the work that you're doing and the things that you're saying as well. I think one of the challenges, it's often really much easier to organize around something that you're against, and Scott Walker has provided a real gift to progressives and Democrats in that regard, because it's so clear what the differences are. I think the challenge, often the more difficult part, is often defining and articulating in a clear way what we're for. And
right.
I think in the long term, that's really the important thing. One of the things that Barack Obama said during his 2008 campaign that really struck me is, and as a community organizer, it's really true, lasting change comes from the bottom up. And I think it's important to realize that the thing that really gets people involved and sustains their involvement and their energy over a period of time is not so much the candidates, which tends to be cyclical every 2 to 4 years, but the issues that affect real families. And I think it's important that we focus sort of in the process of community organizing and building a base of progressive action to make sure that we're taking the time to talk with people and inform people, educate people about the issues that affect them in their real lives.
Well,
absolutely.
And first
yes.
I'm going to ask you both to kind of speak up just a little bit because I can't turn you up, so I apologize about that. But coming back to some of the question, the messaging, how is it that we can get a concise message to be able to all rally behind? I mean, the right seems to have one message that everyone can push. When one of the things that Liz said is that no one was asking what the message is at the AFP meeting. All they were saying is push the message. How can we get behind a concise message? Or how can we get a concise message out there that the grassroots can all get behind and we can push that would actually make it easy for people who aren't in the base to understand what we're trying to do?
Well, I think it's really important to understand the most important organizing and communication skill is listening. And I think we need to do a good job. That's the starting point. I think the thing I found, I served as coordinator of Wisconsin Governor's Conference on Children and Families. We had over 1,000 people from all over the state, all but two counties out of 72 counties that came to a three-day conference. And they were all over the place in terms of the political spectrum, from the Eagle Forum on the far right to progressive groups. And the thing that's interesting that I discovered, when you sit down in this room and allow people to talk to each other without labels, actually there's a fair amount of agreement in terms of what some of the issues are. Generally, people are looking for good jobs, good schools, safe communities, affordable health care, clean environment, and fair taxes. And I think we need to be able to talk to those issues in clear and understandable terms in terms of what the choices are. One of the other things that I think is also helpful is to remind people that every dollar they spend is a vote for some kind of economic system, some kind of future. And I think we need to look at our choices not just in terms of the candidates every 2 or every 4 years or whenever the elections come up, but in terms of the choices that we have to make every day. And we can make choices in terms of how we spend our dollars and what kind of economic system we want to support.
Scott?
Very true. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the wonderful things about grassroots and progressivism is that there are so many ideas that people rally behind. For some, it's education. For some, it's collective bargaining. For some, it's social rights, women's rights, civil rights, you know, justice issues, things like that. Economic justice. And just my opinion, and I've written about this, I think if we can encapsulate it into a message that, look, all these issues are a manifestation of one struggle, and that struggle is the supreme issue that we have to focus on, is the encroachment of the powerful few upon the rights of the many. And if we can use that as the basis of the message across the state, everyone can find something that resonates within that issue that affects them personally. Maybe it's a job, loss of benefits, loss of pay at a job, loss of a job due to, you know, union busting or loss of collective bargaining. The, you know, public education funds being diminished and staff cuts and compromised public education, whatever those issues are.
There's a huge issue, too, that I think is becoming an overriding issue, and that's the loss of our democracy. It affects all of those other issues. And it's a big one, with some small victories lately with some court decisions on the voter ID law. I think the things that Scott mentioned that are absolutely critical is that we are probably near a tipping point in terms of our ability to preserve some sense of real participation, real democracy in our economic and our political system because of the growing influence and power of corporate wealth and the ability of anonymous political corporate contributions to essentially buy favors in the political system.
So how could you actually galvanize people to get behind that? That seems to be a pretty central to everything that's going on. Is that something that people are even thinking about? Is that just something for the political wonks out there?
I think we need to really talk to people in terms that they can understand about what's at stake with this election, with the recalls, beyond that in November. But really, again, almost on a daily basis, with the corporate domination of the media, the ability of people to influence the institutions and the programs and services that provide the quality of life that they have become accustomed to is imperiled by the growing domination of corporate influence and corporate money in politics. And one of the things that I have been thinking about a lot, in fact, I wrote an article on it that I hope to submit, called the debt trap, is that we have a whole generation of young people growing up who are going to be essentially indentured servants because of the huge amount of student debt, of credit card debt, of mortgages and so on, to the point that people who are so much in debt are unlikely to be able to really get involved politically to the extent that they could and should be for fear of losing a promotion or fearing of losing a job. And what does it mean to have a democracy in that context when people are essentially walking around with economic ankle bracelets that constrain their movements and their choices and their ability to participate in the democratic system that's supposed to be of, by, and for the people?
I couldn't agree more.
That was my rant.
I couldn't agree more, and that really, it does come down to that, you know, the few, you know, the encroachment of a powerful few upon the rights of the many, in that, you know, what does freedom mean in this country? Is it the freedom for those powerful corporatist few to have their way and, you know, indenture, put us in indentured servitude, or is it, you know, the freedom to exist free of those shackles? And
one of the biggest things that, you know, I think issues that need to be tackled is the whole issue of Citizens United and the assertion by the Supreme Court that corporations are people. I mean, the cacophony of anonymous corporate contributions effectively drowns out the voice of people, to the point that money has obviously more impact than people's vote or individuals' voice in this situation. And I think that's a great peril to our whole concept of what it means to have a democracy.
And that's something that everybody agrees on. It's interesting because if you poll that question, you know, liberals, conservatives, progressives alike all agree that money is not speech, that corporations are not people, and that has damaged our democracy. And that is definitely a starting point for people, kind of a jumping off point, and it's indicative of the entire problem that we're facing. And I think what we're talking about is just a few of those talking points and those issues that resonate with everybody. That's how we you know, start pushing back and fighting back against this unlimited power.
I'm actually gonna break in here.
Sure, go ahead.
This is an absolute
you're losing control, Sarah.
Well, I was enjoying the conversation, but there's a couple questions I want to get in here, and sure, we're running out of time. If we had another hour, I'd just let you guys go because I'm just enjoying you guys talking.
We'll have to do it again.
Oh, well, definitely going to do this again. But given the current recall election cycles and the fact that everyone is pushing so hard right now, there's a lot of movement to get recall Walker and get him out of office and put someone else in. There's a lot of movement with the senators. Then we have August and November elections, and none of this is going to be – these elections will help with the people who are pushing for them. They feel that these elections are going to help change the way the state is. But in order to get more of that accomplished, there's going to be a sustained – movement that has to go on for year, 2 years, 3 years to get some of these other changes in. How is it that you could keep people at a high participation rate? How can you sustain participation as some people, because some people are going to burn out, some people aren't going to understand the whole day. They just see one aspect of it, the elections, and then they're done. How do
That's why we have really been pushing in Oregon with Oregon Area Progressives to try to do some things that are actually sort of fun. To sort of help, you know, pull people together to recreate a sense of community, to provide some solidarity and some support for people who are involved in the daily battles in the trenches, to do some things that will both inform and educate, but also to help inspire and motivate people to hang in there for the long term, because the issues are critical, and it's going to be more than an election or two, or even more than 2 or 3 years. This really has got to be part of a twilight struggle, you know, to take back our democracy.
Scott?
One of the things I think that's really... Oh, I'm sorry, Scott. Go ahead.
No, please, Charles. Go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that's really critical is helping get the information out there so people can speak on issues and be well informed of what's happening in this country, what's going on. And I think we need to aggressively attack some of the myths that are out there. There's this whole myth about, well, you can't raise taxes on the 1% because they're the job creators. And the reality is that is totally bogus. In fact, under Bush, with over $2 trillion in tax breaks, there was the slowest job creation in more than half a century. And the thing that I found very interesting, I actually put together some charts, and I'd be happy to send them to anybody who's interested, taking a look at some of the demographics and some of the metrics. Between 1965 and 2008, I took a look at those years when Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and the White House. I took a look at those years when both houses of Congress and White House were controlled by the Democrats. And on average, deficits when the Republicans controlled everything were 332% higher. Federal spending, 415% higher when Republicans controlled everything. And yet you have this myth that Republicans are the party of small government and lower spending and all this baloney. And we really need to attack that and help people understand that the Republican Party has basically perpetrated a fraud. They have been increasing spending dramatically, and they've been taking away money from needed programs to provide more and more tax breaks for the rich that haven't created jobs.
So do you feel then that, because you're talking a lot about messaging, do you feel that messaging is more important than something to the effect of getting out the vote activities, or do you feel that they're both have a place? Or
They're one in the same.
Yeah, I think they're related. I mean, messaging is the means by which you get out the vote, I think. You know, people need to understand the issues. They need to be motivated and mobilized to take action in the electoral sphere, but understand that things aren't over for the elections. One of the things I think that is a problem, and in fact, it was interesting when Obama ran the first time around, my kids were actually the ones that got me involved initially, and my initial reaction to Obama was a little bit suspicious. I'm suspicious of charisma, because often what happens is it leads people to sort of assume that they can just elect somebody who's dynamic and charismatic and then sit back and changes will happen, and that never is the case. And one of the things that got me turned on to Obama was I think he understood that, and he never said it was, yes, I can. It was always, yes, we can. And that's been critical.
Just to add to what Charles was saying, I agree, and I know you're running out of time, so I just want to get this in quickly. I think that's why we are taking this action of starting this statewide organization, because this movement is very much still in its infancy, and it's made great strides. But what we're seeing now is this very diverse and non-connected group of organizations all over the state, north, south, east, west, central, everywhere. There's grassroots organizations at the local level affecting local politics. And by connecting them through a statewide database and access so that they can talk to each other, interact with each other, both electronically and directly, you know, we can keep people engaged by, you know, bringing those local organizations involved into legislation activities and policy activities and interacting directly with candidates and politicians at the local and statewide level.
I think messaging is
a huge part of that, which is why like part of what we're doing is going to be like a think tank to get that messaging out to groups throughout the state that they can coalesce action around.
How important do you feel is that kind of a network? If we can network to all the different grassroots groups out there, do you feel that, especially with the left, where a lot of people describe the left and grassroots as like herding cats, do you feel that getting that network together is something that will obviously strengthen it and people could actually come together and say, okay, this worked here, this worked here, this didn't, this worked over here, and really start a big push? Or do you feel that there's going to be so many groups that just aren't going to be interested in that and they're going to keep doing what they're doing as we're doing it now?
Well, I would think they would be interested in having statewide impact, which is why, you know, we'll be organized around a platform where the power is in the grassroots members. And there will be annual conventions where a platform is adopted and a board is voted on, and that will direct action for the entire year.
Scott, that's okay. We're going to let Charles speak real fast because I have about 2 minutes left, and I've got to get you guys
Sorry to sort of jump in here. I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that people are being pulled in a lot of directions. There are a lot of demands being placed on their time. There are a lot of struggles that people are dealing with that make it very difficult for them to get involved in things. They're trying to often just survive. So I think it's really important that we engage and involve people in things that really have a chance to make a difference. We a lot to
change the institution.
Yeah, we like to spend a lot of time talking, and talking is important, but we need to be able to find ways to translate the talk and those issues into concerted action where we can work together to try to actually change the institutions and the policies that have a direct impact on people's lives. And one of the things, if I could put in a real quick plug,
I know we've got an economic thing you wanted to talk about with you have 5 seconds and then I got to go.
Economic Development Conference is going to be coming up, Economic Democracy Conference coming up this fall. Would like people to get involved.
Okay, and what we'll do is we will have you both on again very soon, and we will discuss that when you get back on again. So, okay, thank you so much for both of you coming on. Scott Wyckoff from Badger Democracy and Charles Uphoff from the Oregon Area Progressives. Thank you for coming on today, guys.
Thank you, Sarah.
A pleasure.
Have a great day. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank Bill, my producer. We're really short on time, so I'm going to rush this. I'd like to thank Bill, my producer, for his hard work on the show. And the music you heard today was from The Tools and Peter Gabriel. And we're pretty much done. So thank you so much again. Remember, Wisconsin, 46 days left until the recall election. Make sure you are registered to vote. Have a great week, everyone.